From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Maria Zakharova is a spokesperson for Russia's foreign ministry. She held her weekly press conference on Thursday, and we bring you as much of that as time will allow.
And I'll start with the agenda of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Russian Federation, Minister Lavrov. On the 20th of August, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia will host the negotiations between Minister Lavrov with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade Promotion of Malta, and we plan that the ministers of our countries will talk about the present state of affairs in our political dialogue, as well as development trade, economic, cultural, and humanitarian relations between the two countries, as well as most relevant international issues, including Russia's interactions with the EU, OSCE, Council of Europe, and state of affairs in Syria, Libya, and Ukraine. And the negotiations will take place as part of the private visit of the head of the Foreign Ministry of Malta, which is planned for 18th of August in the State Museum Tsaritsyna, due to the opening of an exhibition of Dmitry Levitsky, portrait of Catherine II, from the collection of the Presidential Palace in Valletta. And on 20th of August, Minister Lavrov will also make a presentation at the inauguration of the historic and documentary exposition 1939, beginning of World War II. And here we will have materials from the Ministry's archive, which reconstruct the actual turn of events and the real reasons behind the world conflict and the culprits. And the events will receive the head of the Rosarchive and head of the Russian History Society. Among the organizers, we have largest federal archives, including Russia's Archive of Military History and the Department of History and Documentation of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia. And today, judging by the news we received from other region, from Moscow region, where Minister Lavrov spoke at one of the very popular fora, the territory of meaning, and based on the news we received from there, I read that he announced his meeting and negotiations with his German colleague, and I can give the details. On 21st, 22nd of August, we'll receive the working visit of the Federal Minister of Foreign Affairs of Germany and the head of the Foreign Ministry of Russia will meet with his colleague on 21st of August, conduct the negotiations, and the ministers of our countries will talk about the key issues of the bilateral agenda, as well as will compare the agenda of political context. They will focus on inter-regional and inter-societal connections, as well as scientific, educational, cultural, humanitarian, and trade economic aspects. They will deepen their interaction and exchange of opinions on the situation of with international problems, including situation in Ukraine, Syria, as well as situation around Iran and global stability and strategic security. Now going passing to the international agenda and Russia's approaches to important international aspects. The situation in Syria is still rather tense, and we see serious situation in Idlib de-escalation zone. The militants of the terrorist alliance Hayat-Tahrir al-Sham continue firings against Russian military facilities and attempts of Russia and Syria to introduce on the 2nd of August this ceasefire regime were ignored, and we saw over 200 cases of breaches of the ceasefire regime, and there are victims among the peaceful population, and with the support of the Russian aviation, Syrian military forces conduct targeted operations to ensure the security of the civil population within the de-escalation zone. Russian side is still committed to the Sochi Memorandum of 17th of September 2018 regarding the creation of the demilitarization zone, and we believe that it should not be, however, used as a pretext for protection and covering up for terrorists, which were recognized as such by the Security Council of the UN. And we expect that our and Turkish partners will also take into consideration this memorandum and use it as guiding light in their actions. And we also see increasing preoccupation regarding the attempts to separate the northeastern Syria, and our approach has not changed. We're still all for long-term stability and security and the northeastern part of Syria, and believe in resultative dialogue of Damascus with Kurds as in the interest of Syrian people. And since Russia declared its initiative summer last year, over 360,000 people returned to Syria, and all of them obviously receive help and support in order to go back to normal life already on the territory where they have always lived before. And along the humanitarian track, we continue working on the dissemination of the IDPs camp and Atanf, and today we have evacuated over 18,000 people from there, and until the end of August, with the support of UN structures, we hope to finish the withdrawal of peaceful population, civil population from Rubkan. And as far as the IDP camp Al-Hawla is concerned, unfortunately, we do not see any positive dynamic in this respect. This camp continues to be some kind of prison under the open sky, and we see an increase in infectious diseases there. They still lack basic necessities in medicine, and the situation in this camp only strengthened the radical and extremist views of the radical population of this inhabitants of the people that are there, who have been radicalized. And this specifically concerns the youth. We call upon the international society to focus its efforts on post-conflict reconstruction and providing humanitarian support to all Syrians without any exceptions and political prerequisites. And here we see that there's a need for financial support for the UN mass, as it has been done by Russia. And in political aspects, we are optimistic and think that there are all the prerequisites for bringing together a constitutional committee, which would give a start to the negotiations between Syrians on the future of their country. And as it is stated by the Resolution 2254 of the Security Council of the United Nations, and on our part, we will continue giving support to the Special Envoy of the Secretary General of the UN, Mr. Peterson, in forming this committee. And now, going to Libya, we continue receiving very worrying news from there. And despite the initiative of the Special Envoy of the Secretary General of the UN, and that it was stated that there would be a ceasefire for the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha, we saw some surges in violence on 10th of August in Benghazi. Terrorists blew up a car filled with explosives. As a result, three members of the UN mission on support mission in Libya lost their lives, and over 10 people were wounded. And we saw a new turn of escalation at the negotiations at the emergency meeting in the Security Council, and we talked about various terrorist attacks which threatened the security for Libyans and work of the representatives of international organizations represented in that country. And we see that this conflict in Libya directly plays into the hands of terrorist and extremist groups, and in the context of this lack of power, this vacuum in central power, and lack of effective state structures, terrorists feel more freely day by day. And this explosion in Benghazi is yet another example, and we believe that putting an end to terrorism in Libya is only possible through well-coordinated efforts of the national patriotic forces, both on the west and in the east of the country. And we often see that the situation is communicated to the international society, and it lacks, unfortunately, clarity in phrasing, and in this respect, we proceed based on the need to make the first step and establish a long-term ceasefire regime, and also call upon Libyan military and political forces to sit down at the negotiations table and talk about inclusive political process with the ultimate purpose of overcoming the division in the country and forming united, effective state institutions which would be capable of returning peace and prosperity to the Libyan soil. Going to Venezuela now. The same characteristic could probably apply here too. The situation there continues to be tense, and our calls to Washington to cancel the sanctions regime, at least for the social sphere, and in this respect help to improve the humanitarian situation in the country, have been ignored. Moreover, the White House continues to try to pressurize the people of the sovereign state, which doesn't want to leave behind its priority principles, which doesn't want to end up under management from outside, and this just deepens this dead-end situation, and we see this total blockade of Venezuela and readiness to take any steps necessary, according to Washington, to counteract Maduro, and all this rhetoric is well known. They just periodically increase this degree of heat, and the situation is just deteriorated intentionally, and we underscore the need to guide themselves based on the UN Charter and state that it's inadmissible to use unilateral measures and intervene in the internal affairs of foreign states, but Washington continues to apply its own rules and proceeds based on its own interests only, and in this respect we can talk about Washington as a group of people or some part of the political elite, but not Washington as the capital of an entire state, because the actions which are taken by the ministry, by the political establishment, the part that has access to administration, have nothing to do with the interests of the people of the United States. It's just obvious because all of these actions result in global destabilization of situation in the region, and how can this possibly be in the interest of the people of the United States is impossible to fathom, and this can correspond to the interests of part of the elites, maybe political or even commercial elites, which are probably involved in the energy sector, but saying something specifically, it is hard to say that it's in the interest of the entire nation, although it's these high ideals that the Washington administration actually publicly declares and explains it as brings it up as its motivation. And I would also like to say that the approach which Washington has chosen and which has been demonstrated over the last weeks will only result in an increase in the contradictions in the Venezuela itself and will push the political opponents to some forceful confrontation. So over these weeks there has been some real effort to take the conflict from some bordering on negotiations stage with international mediation. Why would anyone bring the situation back to total chaos and turn it into a story which can soon turn into some open conflict and transform into the stage without any exit strategy is a huge question. And unfortunately, the British are also in line with their partners, and they continue constructing a military base at the estuary of the Essequibo River, and they say it's to fight the smuggling of drugs and arms.
Several dozens of the so-called refugees from Venezuela have already arrived there. In fact, those are the people who have arrived to complete training for the recon and diversion groups in order to work in Venezuela and destabilize the situation and commit relevant actions from extremist to terrorist actions. At the same time, the media campaign also continues, aimed at discrediting the legal and legitimate authorities of Venezuela. The Western mass media are purposefully spreading information containing accusations. I can give you one of the quotes which can be used as a slogan demonstrating the essence of this campaign. They say, this country is one of the largest drug threats to the US, and they are talking about Venezuela. We have the official data on the drug threat in the region. For example, we can take a look at the special reports made by the UN Office for Drugs and Crime. And if they do not wish to look at the UN data, perhaps that's too boring for them. The US authorities give precedence to the NGOs, and there are estimations by the relevant NGOs. And the most paradoxical thing is that there is an annual report by the US Department of State. And if they took a look at the report itself, they would see the clear situation and they would understand what exactly are the countries who deliver drugs to the Western Hemisphere, and that is not Venezuela. Although, when we're talking about the mass media of the United States of America, they have created the slogan that Venezuela is to blame for all the drug hardships and threats of the region. That's absurd, but they also intentionally keep silence about the objective successes of Caracas in countering the drug threat. From 2005 to 2018, the Venezuela border forces have seized over 700 tons of drugs, and it is deeply regrettable that the US prefers to ignore these facts, which have been confirmed by the Venezuelan authorities and the international authorities as well. The US administration, following the established traditions to escalate the tensions and forceful pressure against Caracas, only makes the situation worse and adds fuel to the fire by saying that, I quote, the time for dialogue has passed, it's time to act. Let me remind you that the exact same phrase was used against Libya several years ago. The time for any dialogue and any ways of negotiation is over. It is time to act. And now nobody knows how to settle the situation in Libya and how to make it at least close to negotiations. The slogan is still alive and now it is used against Venezuela. We consider such statements counterproductive, reckless, and historically tested as unreliable. And we also had the words of the US Air Force Commander, Mr. Fowler, concerning the development of the aid plan for Venezuela after the resignation of Maduro. Once again, we've seen this before. I do not believe, and I refuse to believe, that the Trump administration, which has such special attention to the Obama administration heritage, seem to ignore the fact that Obama spearheaded the plan for aiding Syria after Assad's resignation. Why repeat the mistakes made in Syria and the mistakes made by the people who do you not wish to follow? It is clear that the legitimate Venezuelan authorities will not conduct this dialogue in the conditions of blackmail. They have a pistol aimed at their head by the US. We consider it necessary to maintain a constructive atmosphere around the Oslo process. We underline that the resumption of the talks of the political opponent would be impossible without understanding and restraint by the responsible members of the world community, and we call on the foreign states and Venezuelan politicians to continue finding ways for political solution through inclusive dialogue without ultimatums and preliminary conditions. Now moving on to Ukraine and the situation in Donbas. In the recent week, the number of shellings by the Ukrainian armed forces in spite of the truce has significantly increased, although everyone expected the opposite. It is possible that the goal of this stabilization is an attempt to provoke return fire of the militias and declare once again about that Donetsk and Lugansk are to blame for breaking the truce. Such massive shellings and such scale of the destruction of military or rather civilian infrastructure, including the housing objects and so on, had not been seen even before the declaration of the comprehensive and indefinite summer truce. Starting from the 21st of July, 20 houses were destroyed or damaged. In 14 cases, the Ukrainian armed forces were using mortars of various calibers, firing overall over 60 mines. So much for a truce. On the 12th of August, following a mortar shelling in the locality of October, 14 houses were destroyed or damaged. Their power line and a gas pipeline were destroyed. The armed forces of Ukraine were seen to be using the strike drones to perform attacks against the civilian towns and villages. According to our information, on the 12th of August, two of such drones were downed by the people's militias of the Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics. This is an absolutely atrocious fact that school number 30 in Korolevka is constantly being shelled. This is not a myth and not a fake. This fact was reported by the special monitoring mission of the OSCE on the 9th of August. And if the Ukrainian president is so concerned by the situation in Donbas, as he said during an emergency briefing on the 7th of August, why didn't he ask the law enforcers and the armed forces to investigate this fact? Does he not have control over them? Once again, we have the public statements, and even if he doesn't have the whole authority, perhaps he should start with the tools that he has by clearly formulating the position and saying that such acts are unacceptable. We call on the world community not to turn a blind eye to the events and stop covering up for the Ukrainian military, who are deliberately destroying the population of Donbas. And now, I cannot ignore this piece of news. We are moving on to the news from the area of absurdity. I would like to be precise in my formulas. So, behind the looking glass, recently, Kyiv declared that Ukraine has no debt to the Commonwealth of Independent States. And they also quoted the relevant authorities. In particular, they quoted Budnar, saying that Kremlin supposedly leaves no chances to reclaim control over Ukraine, including using the tools of the CIS. They also said that back in the day, Ukraine used to be a member of the CIS, but they were not full participants of the CIS since they had not signed the charter. They also said that Ukraine was one of the founder states, but For the 6 consecutive years, Ukraine has not signed any document adopted by the CIS bodies, and therefore Ukraine cannot have any debt to the CIS since Ukraine is not a member of the organization. Once again, we're talking about an official statement, although it is hard to say which is official and which is not. Let us face the facts. This is ridiculous and absurd. Let's take a look at the matter of Ukraine's membership in the organization. They say that they were a founder, but since they hadn't signed any documents, this means they are not members and have no debt. How is that possible? They have some ridiculous ideas about the international structures and international obligations. So I asked the experts to prepare information pertaining to this. In the recent years, we have seen the reduced activities of the CIS. In 2014, Ukraine refused to preside in the CIS. They recalled their politicians from the bodies of the CIS. They have minimized their participation in the statutory bodies, and then they closed down their mission to the CIS in Minsk. But legally, Ukraine continues to be a member and participant of the CIS. They receive invitations to the statutory bodies sessions. They are informed about the decisions and so on. I haven't seen any document asking the CIS authorities not to inform and not to invite Ukraine to the sessions. Moreover, a couple of years ago, at the level of embassies, Ukrainian was taking part in a meeting of the diplomatic corps in Moscow. And they were taking part in the meetings, they were taking part in the lunches and the dinners and so on, but in spite of the Kyiv statements saying that they intend to break up with the Commonwealth of Independent States, there have been no official notifications at the Executive Council of the CIS. And I would like this to be heard in Ukraine by the people who are trying to once again fool the public. There is no other word for this. They are trying to lie to the people. Kyiv did not officially withdraw from the relevant councils of the CIS. The fact is, Kyiv understands that a formal withdrawal from the CIS would result in breaking a number of international treaties which have a limited number of participants. They are only limited to the CIS member states, and the continuation of these treaties could be useful for Ukraine. Currently, Ukraine has withdrawn from 15 international treaties of this kind. At the same time, Ukraine remains a member of about 12 treaties. And at the same time, we hear statements by the people who associate themselves with the authorities saying that Ukraine is not a member of the CIS. How is that possible? As for the financement of the CIS activities, Ukraine stopped paying its contribution to the budget of the CIS in 2014, and the current debt of Kyiv to the CIS is over 300 million rubles. This is not related with Ukraine's withdrawal from the CIS in accordance with the charter. This was just an independent decision by Ukraine, and there have been no limitations on Ukraine's participation in the CIS.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.